The late afternoon fog was a cape that flapped open to admit Vic McQueen and her mean machine, then flapped shut behind her, swallowing even the sound of the engine. "Come on, Hooper," Wayne said. "Let's go in." Hooper stood on the margin of the road, staring at him uncomprehendingly. Wayne called again when he was in the house. He held the door open, waiting for his dog to come to him. Instead, Hooper turned his big shaggy head and peered back along the road, not in the direction Wayne's mother had ridden, but the other way. Wayne couldn't tell what he was looking at. Who knew what dogs saw, what the shapes in the mist meant to them, what odd, superstitious notions they might hold. Wayne was certain dogs were as superstitious as humans. More, maybe. "Suit yourself," Wayne said, and shut the door. He sat in front of the TV with his iPhone in one hand and texted with his dad for a few minutes. "Are you at the airport yet?" "Yep. They pushed my flight back to 3, so I'm gonna be sitting here a while." "That sucks. What are you gonna do?" "Gonna hit the food court. Gonna hit it so hard it cries."
"Mom got the bike going. She's out riding around."
"She wearing her helmet?"
"Yes, I made her. Coat, too."
"Good for you. That coat adds +5 to all armor rolls."
"LOL. I love you. Have a safe flight."
"If I die in a plane crash, remember to always bag and board your comics. Love you, too."
Then there was nothing more to say.
Wayne reached for the remote control, switched on the TV, found SpongeBob. His official stance was that he had grown out of SpongeBob, but with his mother gone, he could dispense with the official stance and do what he liked. Hooper barked. Wayne got up and went to the picture window, but he couldn't see Hooper anymore. The big dog had vanished into the watery white vapor. He listened intently, wondering if the bike was coming back. It felt as if his mother had been gone longer than 5 minutes. His eyes refocused, and he saw the TV reflected in the picture window. SpongeBob was wearing a scarf and talking to Santa Claus. Santa stuck a steel hook through SpongeBob's brains and threw him into his bag of toys. Wayne jerked his head around, but SpongeBob was talking to Patrick, and there wasn't any Santa Claus. He was on his way back to the couch when he heard Hooper at the front door at last, his tail going thump, 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 just as it had that morning.
"Coming," he said. "Hold your horses."
But when he opened the door, it wasn't Hooper at all. It was a short, hairy, fat man in a tracksuit, gray with gold stripes, the sleeves pushed back to show his forearms. His head was a patchy bristle, as if he had mange. His eyes protruded from above his broad, flattened nose.
"Hello," he said. "Can I use your phone? We've had a terrible accident. We've just hit a dog with our car."
He spoke haltingly, like a man reading his lines from a cue card but having trouble making out the words.
"What?" Wayne asked. "What did you say?"
The ugly man gave him a worried look and said, "Hello? Can I use your phone? We've had a terrible accident. We've just hit a dog with our car." They were all the same words, but with emphasis in different places, as if he were not sure which sentences were questions and which were declarations. Wayne looked past the ugly little man. Back down the road, he saw what looked like a dirty roll of white carpet lying in front of a car. In the pale, drifting smoke, it was hard to see either the car or the white mound clearly. Only it wasn't a roll of carpet, of course. Wayne knew exactly what it was.
"We didn't see it, and it was right in the road. We hit it with our car," the little man said, gesturing over his shoulder.
A tall man stood in the mist next to the right front tire. He was bent over, his hands on his knees, considering the dog in a speculative sort of way, as if he half expected Hooper to get back up. The little man looked down at his palm for a moment, then back up and said,
"It was a terrible accident."
He smiled hopefully.
"Can I use your phone?"
"What?" Wayne said again, although he had heard the man perfectly well, even through the ringing in his ears. And besides, he had said the same thing 3 times now, with almost no variation at all.
"Hooper! Hooper!"
He pushed past the little man. He did not run, but went at a fast walk, his gait jerky and stiff.
Hooper looked as if he had dropped onto his side and gone to sleep in the road in front of the car. His legs stuck out straight from his body. His left eye was open, staring up at the sky, filmy and dull. But as Wayne approached, it moved to track him. Still alive.
"Oh, God, boy," Wayne said.
He sank to his knees.
"Hooper!"
In the glare of the headlights, the mist was revealed as 1,000 fine grains of water trembling in the air. Too light to fall, they blew around instead, a rain that wouldn't rain. Hooper pushed creamy drool out of his mouth with his thick tongue. His belly moved in rapid, panting breaths. Wayne couldn't see any blood.
"My lord," said the man who stood looking down at the dog, "that is what you call bad luck. I am so sorry. The poor thing. You can bet he does not know what happened to him, though. You can take some consolation from that."
Wayne looked past the dog at the man standing by the front of the car. The man wore black boots that came almost to his knees and a tailcoat with rows of brass buttons on either side of the placket. As Wayne lifted his gaze, he took in the car as well. It was an antique, an oldie but a goodie, his father would say. The tall man held a silver hammer in his right hand, a hammer the size of a croquet mallet. The shirt beneath his coat was watered white silk, as smooth and shiny as fresh-poured milk. Wayne lifted his gaze the rest of the way. Charlie Mank stared down at him with large, fascinated eyes.
"God bless dogs and children," he said. "This world is too hard a place for them. The world is a thief, and it steals your childhood from you, and all the best dogs do. But believe this, he is on his way to a better place now."
Charlie Mank still looked like his mugshot, although he was older, old going on ancient. A few silver hairs were combed across his spotted, bare skull. His scant lips were parted to show a horribly colorless tongue, as white as dead skin.
He was as tall as Lincoln and just as dead. Wayne could smell the death on him, the stink of decay.
"Don't touch me," Wayne said.
He got up on unsteady legs and took a single step backward before he thumped into the ugly little man standing behind him. The little man gripped him by the shoulders, forcing him to remain facing Manx. Wayne twisted his head to look back. If he had the air, he would have screamed. The man behind him had a new face. He wore a rubber gas mask with a grotesque valve where his mouth belonged and glossy plastic windows for eyes. If eyes were windows to the soul, then the gas mask man's offered a view of profound emptiness.
"Help!" Wayne screamed. "Help me!"
"That is my aim exactly," said Charlie Manx.
"Help!" Wayne screamed again.
"I scream, you scream, we all scream for ice cream," the gas mask man said. "Keep shouting. See if that's what you get. Big hint, bucko. No ice cream for screamers."
"Help!" Wayne shouted.
Charlie Manx put his gaunt fingers over his ears and made a pained face.
"That is a lot of filthy noise.
Boys who make filthy noise don't get any toys," the gas mask man said. "Boys who yelp get no help."
Wayne wanted to vomit. He opened his mouth to scream again, and Manx reached out and pressed a finger to his lips.
"Shh!"
Wayne almost flinched at the smell of it, an odor of formaldehyde and blood.
"I am not going to hurt you. I would not hurt a child. There is no need for a lot of caterwauling. My business is with your mother. I am sure you are a fine boy. All children are, for a while. But your mother is a lying scallywag who has given false witness against me. That is not the end of it either. I have children of my own, and she kept me from them for years and years. For a decade I could not see their sweetly smiling faces, although I heard their voices often enough in dreams. I heard them calling for me, and I know they went hungry. You cannot think what it is like to know your children are in need and that you cannot help them. It will drive a normal man to madness. Of course, some would say I did not have far to drive."
At this, both men laughed.
"Please,"
Wayne said. Let me go!
Do you want me to gas him out, Mr. Manx? Is it time for some gingerbread smoke?
Manx folded his hands at his waist and frowned.
A short nap might be the best thing. It is hard to reason with a child who is so overwrought.
The gas-masked man began to force-march Wayne around the front of the car. Wayne saw now that it was a Rolls-Royce, and he flashed to one of Maggie Lee's newspaper articles. Something about a man disappearing in Kentucky, along with a 1938 Rolls.
Hooper! Wayne screamed.
He was being propelled past the dog. Hooper twisted his head, as if snapping at a fly, moving with more life than Wayne would have guessed possible. He bit, shutting his teeth on the gas mask man's left ankle. The gas mask man squealed and stumbled. Wayne thought for an instant that he might leap free, but the little man had long, powerful arms, like a baboon's, and he got his forearm around Wayne's throat.
"Oh, Mr. Manx," the gas mask man said. "He's biting. The dog is biting. He's got his teeth in me."
Manx raised the silver hammer and dropped it on Hooper's head. Like a man at a fair, using a sledgehammer to test his strength, hitting the target to see if he could ring a bell. Hooper's skull crunched like a light bulb under a boot heel. Manx hit him a second time to be sure. The gas mask man tore his foot free and turned sideways and kicked Hooper for good measure.
"You dirty dog," the gas mask man cried. "I hope that hurt. I hope that hurt a lot."
When Manx straightened up, there was fresh, wet blood glistening on his shirt in a rough Y shape. It seeped through the silk, trickling from some wound on the old man's chest.
"Hooper,"
Wayne said. He meant to scream it, but it came out as a whisper, barely audible even to himself. Hooper's white fur was stained all red now. It was like blood on snow. Wayne couldn't look at what had been done to his head. Manx bent over the dog, catching his breath.
"Well, this pup has chased his last flock of pigeons."
"You killed Hooper," Wayne said.
Charlie Manx said, "Yes, it looks like I have, the poor thing. That is too bad. I have always tried to be a friend to dogs and children. I will try to make it up to you, young man. Consider that I owe you one. Put him in the car, Bing, and give him something to take his mind off his cares."
The gas mask man shoved Wayne ahead of him, hopping along, keeping his weight off his right ankle. The back door of the Rolls-Royce popped and swung wide. No one was sitting in the car. No one had touched the latch. Wayne was baffled, amazed even, but did not linger on it. Things were moving quickly now, and he couldn't afford to give it thought. Wayne understood that if he climbed into the back seat, he would never climb out again. It would be like climbing into his own grave. Hooper, though, had tried to show him what to do. Hooper had tried to show him that even when you seemed completely overpowered, you could still show your teeth. Wayne turned his head and sank his teeth into the fat man's forearm. He locked his jaw and bit down until he tasted blood. The gas mask man shrieked, "It hurts! He's hurting me!" His hand opened and shut. Wayne saw, in close focus, words written in black marker on the gas mask man's palm. "Phone, accident, car."
"Bing," hissed Mr. Manx. "Shh, put him in the car and hush yourself."
Bing, the gas mask man, grabbed a handful of Wayne's hair and pulled. Wayne felt as if his scalp were being ripped up like old carpet. Still, he put one foot up, bracing it against the side of the car. The gas mask man moaned and punched Wayne in the side of the head. It was like a flashbulb going off. Only instead of a flash of white light, it was a flash of blackness behind his eyes. Wayne dropped the foot braced against the side of the car. As his vision cleared, he was pushed through the open door and fell onto all fours on the carpet.
"Bing," Manx cried. "Close that door. Someone is coming. That dreadful woman is coming."
"Your ass is grass," the gas mask man said to Wayne. Your ass is so much grass, and I am the lawnmower. I'm going to mow your ass, and then I'm going to fuck it. I'm going to fuck you right in the ass. Bing, mind me now.
Mom! Screamed Wayne. I'm coming! She shouted back, tiredly, her voice arriving from a great distance and without any particular urgency. The gas mask man slammed the car door. Wayne rose onto his knees. His left ear throbbed where he had been struck, burned against the side of his face. There was a nasty aftertaste of blood in his mouth. He looked over the front seats and out the windshield. A dark shape walked up the road. The mist played funhouse tricks with the optics, distorting and enlarging the shape. It looked like a grotesque hunchback pushing a wheelchair.
Mom!
Wayne screamed again. The front passenger side door, which was on the left, where the steering wheel would have been in an American car, opened. The gas mask man climbed in, pulled the door shut behind him, then twisted in his seat and pointed a pistol in Wayne's face.
You want to shut your mouth, the gas mask man said, or I'll drill you. I'll pump you full of lead. How would you like that? Not too much, I bet.
The gas mask man considered his right arm. There was a misshapen purple bruise where Wayne had bitten him, enclosed in parentheses of bright blood where Wayne's teeth had broken the skin. Manx slid behind the steering wheel. He put his silver mallet on the leather between him and the gas mask man. The car was running, the engine producing a deep, resonant purr that was felt more than heard, a kind of luxurious vibration. The hunchback with the wheelchair came through the mist, until all at once it resolved into the shape of a woman walking a motorcycle, pushing it laboriously by the handlebars. Wayne opened his mouth to shout for his mother again. The gas mask man shook his head. Wayne stared into the black circle of the barrel. It was not terrifying. It was fascinating, like the view from a high peak at the edge of a straight drop. No more laughing, the gas mask man said. No more fun. Quaker meeting has begun. Charlie Manx dropped the car into drive with a heavy clunk. Then he glanced over his shoulder once more.
Do not mind him, Manx said. He is an old spoil sport. I think we can manage to have some fun. I am all but certain of it. In fact, I am about to have some right now.
Route 3. The bike wouldn't start. It wouldn't even make hopeful noises. She jumped up and down on it until her legs were worn out, but not once did it produce the low, deep, throat-clearing sound that suggested the engine was close to turning over. Instead, it made a soft puff, like a man blowing a contemptuous sigh through his lips. Pfft. There was nothing to do except walk. She bent to the handlebars and began to push. She took three effortful steps, then paused and looked over her shoulder again. Still no bridge. There had never been any bridge. Vic walked and tried to imagine how she would begin the conversation with Wayne. Hey, kid, bad news. I shook something loose on the motorcycle and it got broke. Oh, and I shook something loose in my head, and that got broke, too. I'm going to have to go in for service. When I get settled in the psycho ward, I'll send you a postcard. She laughed. It sounded to her ears much like a sob. Wayne, I want more than anything to be the mom you deserve. But I can't. I can't do it. The thought of saying such a thing made her want to puke. Even if it were true, that didn't make it feel any less cowardly. Wayne, I hope you know I love you. I hope you know I tried. The fog drifted across the road and felt as if it were passing right through her. The day had turned unaccountably chilly for early July. Another voice, strong, clear, masculine, spoke in her thoughts. Her father's voice.
Don't bullshit a bullshitter, kid. You wanted to find the bridge. You went looking for it. That's why you stopped taking your meds. That's why you fixed the bike. What are you really scared of? Scared that you're crazy? Or scared that you aren't?
Vic often heard her father telling her things she didn't want to know, although she had spoken to him only a handful of times in the last 10 years.
She wondered at that, why she still needed the voice of a man who had abandoned her without a look back. She pushed her bike through the damp chill of the mist. Water beaded up on the weird, waxy surface of the motorcycle jacket. Who knew what it was made out of? Some mix of canvas, Teflon, and presumably dragon hide. Vic removed her helmet and hung it off the handlebars, but it wouldn't stay there, kept dropping into the street. Finally, she jammed it back on her head. She pushed, trudging along the side of the road. It crossed her mind she could just leave the bike, come back for it later, but she never seriously entertained the notion. She had walked away from the other bike once, the Raleigh, and had left the best of herself behind with it. When you had a set of wheels that could take you anywhere, you didn't walk away from it. Vic wished, for maybe the first time in her life, that she owned a cell phone. Sometimes it seemed as if she were the last person in America not to have one. She pretended it was a way of showing off her freedom from the 21st century's technological snares. In truth, though, she could not bear the idea of having a phone on her all the time, wherever she went. Could not be at ease knowing she might get an urgent call from Christmasland, some dead kid on the line.
"Hey, Miss McQueen, did you miss us?"
She pushed and walked and pushed and walked. She was singing something under her breath. For a long time, she wasn't even aware she was doing it. She imagined Wayne standing at the window at home, staring out into the rain and fog, shifting nervously from foot to foot. Vic was conscious of, and tried to quash, a gathering feeling of panic out of proportion to the situation. She felt she was needed at home. She had been gone far too long. She was afraid of Wayne's tears and anger, and at the same time looked forward to them, to seeing him, to knowing that everything was all right. She pushed. She sang. "Silent night," she sang. "Holy night." She heard herself and stopped, but the song continued in her head, plaintive and off-key. "All is calm. All is bright." Vic felt feverish in her motorcycle helmet. Her legs were soaked and cold from the fog. Her face was hot and sweaty from her exertions. She wanted to sit down. No, lie down. In the grass. On her back, staring up at the low, curdled sky. But she could see the rental house at last, a dark rectangle on her left, almost featureless in the fog. The day was dim by now, and she was surprised there were no lights on in the cottage, aside from the wan blue glow of the TV. She supposed she was surprised, too, that Wayne wasn't in the window watching for her. But then she heard him.
"Mom!"
he shouted. With her helmet on, his voice was muffled a long way off. She hung her head. He was fine.
"I'm coming," she called back wearily.
She had almost reached the foot of the driveway when she heard a car idling. She looked up. Headlights glowed in the fog. The car they belonged to had been pulled over at the side of the road, but the moment she spotted it, it began to move, sliding up onto the blacktop. Vic stood and watched it, and as the car came forward, shedding the fog, she could not say she was entirely surprised. She had sent him to jail, and she had read his obituary, but some part of her had been waiting to see Charlie Manx and his Rolls-Royce again for her entire adult life. The Wraith slid out of the mist, a black sleigh tearing through a cloud and dragging tales of December frost behind it. December frost in July. The roiling white smoke boiled away from the license plate, old, dented, rust-shot. Nosferatu. Vic let go of the bike, and it fell with a great crash. The mirror on the left handlebar exploded in a pretty spray of silver splinters. She turned and ran. The split rail fence was on her left, and she reached it in two steps and jumped onto it. She made the top cross-tie when she heard the car lunging up the embankment behind her, and she jumped and landed on the lawn and took one more step, and then the Wraith went through the fence. A log helicoptered through the air, whoop, 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 and nailed her across the shoulders. She was slammed off her feet and over the edge of the world, dropped into a bottomless chasm, fell into cold, roiling smoke without end. The Lake House.
The wraith struck the fence of skinned poles, and Wayne was flung off the rear seat and onto the floor. His teeth banged together with a sharp clack. Logs snapped and flew. One of them made a clobbering sound, drumming against the hood. In Wayne's mind, that was the sound of his mother's body hitting the car, and he began to scream. Manx thumped the car into park and turned on the seat to face the gas mask man.
"I do not want him to have to watch any of this," Manx said. "Seeing your dog die in the road is pitiful enough. Will you put him to sleep for me, Bing? Anyone can see he has exhausted himself."
"I ought to help you with the woman."
"Thank you, Bing. That is very thoughtful. No, I have her well in hand."
The car rocked as the men climbed out. Wayne struggled to his knees, lifted his head to look over the front seat, through the window, and into the yard. Charlie Manx had that silver mallet in one hand and was coming around the front of the car. Wayne's mother was flat on the grass amid a scattering of logs. The back left-hand door opened, and the gas mask man climbed in next to Wayne. Wayne lunged to his right, trying to get to the other door, but the gas mask man caught his arm and pulled him over beside him. In one hand he had a little blue aerosol can. It said, "Ginger Snap Spice Air Freshener," on the side, and showed a woman pulling a pan of gingerbread men out of an oven.
"I'll tell you about this stuff right here," the gas mask man said. "It may say ginger snap spice, but what it really smells like is bedtime. You get a mouthful of this, it'll knock you into next Wednesday."
"No," Wayne cried. "Don't!" He flapped like a bird with one wing nailed to a wooden board. He wasn't flying anywhere.
"Oh, I won't," the gas mask man said. "You bit me, you little shit. How do you know I don't have AIDS? You could have it. You could have a big, dirty mouthful of my AIDS now."
Wayne looked over the front seat, through the windshield, into the yard. Manx was pacing around behind Wayne's mother, who still hadn't moved.
"I ought to bite you back, you know," the gas mask man said. "I ought to bite you twice. Once for what you did and once more for your dirty dog. I could bite you in your pretty little face. You have a face like a pretty little girl. But it wouldn't be so pretty if I bit your cheek out and spit it on the floor. But we're just going to sit here instead. We're just going to sit here and watch the show. You watch and see what Mr. Manx does with dirty whores who tell dirty lies. And after he's done with her, after he's done, it'll be my turn. And I'm not half so nice as Mr. Manx."
His mother moved her right hand, opening and closing her fingers, making a loose fist. Wayne felt something unclench inside him. It was as if someone had been standing on his chest and had just stepped off, giving him his first chance in who knew how long to inhale fully. Not dead. Not dead. She was not dead. She swept the hand back and forth, gently, as if feeling in the grass for something she had dropped. She moved her right leg, bending it at the knee. It looked like she wanted to try to get up. Manx bent over her with that enormous silver hammer of his, lifted it, and brought it down. Wayne had never heard bones break before. Manx struck her in the left shoulder, and Wayne heard it pop, like a knothole exploding in a campfire. The force of the blow drove her back down onto her belly. He screamed for her. He screamed with all the air in his lungs and shut his eyes and lowered his head. And the gas mask man grabbed him by his hair and yanked his head back. Something metal smashed Wayne in the mouth. The gas mask man had clubbed him in the face with a can of ginger snap spice. "You open your eyes and watch," the gas mask man said. Wayne's mother moved her right hand, trying to lift herself up, crawl away, and Manx hit her again. Her spine shattered with a sound like someone jumping on a stack of china plates.
Pay attention, the gas mask man said. He was breathing so hard it was steaming up the inside of his mask. We're just getting to the good part.
Under. Vic swam. She was underwater. She was in the lake. She had plunged almost all the way to the bottom, where the world was dark and slow. Vic felt no need for air, was not conscious of holding her breath. She had always liked going deep, into the still, silent, shadowed provinces of fish. Vic could have stayed under forever, was ready to be a trout, but Wayne was calling her from the surface world. His voice was a long way off, yet she still heard the urgency in it, heard that he was not yelling, but screaming. It took an effort to kick for the surface. Her arms and legs didn't want to move. She tried to focus on just one hand, sweeping it at the water. She opened her fingers. She closed her fingers. She opened them again. She opened her hand in the grass. Vic was in the dirt, on her stomach, although the sluggish underwater feeling persisted. She could not fathom, fathom, get it, how she had wound up sprawled in her yard. She could not remember what had hit her. Something had hit her. It was hard to lift her head.
Are you with me, Mrs. Smarty Pants, Victoria McQueen? Someone said.
She heard him, but couldn't register what he was saying. It was irrelevant. Wayne was the thing. She had heard Wayne screaming for her. She was sure of it. She had felt him screaming in her bones. She had to get up and see that he was all right. Vic made an effort to push herself onto all fours, and Manx brought his bright silver hammer down on her shoulder. She heard the bone crack and the arm caved beneath her. She collapsed, bashed the ground with her chin.
I did not say you could get up. I asked if you were listening. You will want to listen to me.
Manx. Manx was here. Not dead. Manx and his Rolls-Royce, and Wayne was in the Rolls-Royce. She knew this last fact as certainly as she knew her own name, although she had not laid eyes on Wayne in half an hour or more. Wayne was in that car, and she had to get him out. She began to push herself up once more, and Charlie Manx came down with his silver hammer again and hit her in the back. And she heard her spine break with a sound like someone stepping on a cheap toy, a brittle, plasticky crunch. The blunt force drove the wind out of her and slammed her back to her stomach. Wayne was screaming again, wordlessly now. Vic wished she could look around for him, get her bearings, but it was almost impossible to pick her head up. Her head felt heavy and strange, unsupportable, too much for her slender neck to bear. The helmet, she thought. She was still wearing her helmet and Lou's jacket. Lou's jacket. Vic had moved one leg, had drawn the knee up, the first part of her plan to get back on her feet. She could feel the dirt under her knee, could feel the muscle in the back of her thigh trembling. Vic had heard Manx pulverize her spine with his second swing, and she was not sure why she could still feel her legs. She was not sure why she wasn't in more pain. Her hamstrings ached more than anything else, bunched tight from pushing the bike half a mile. Everything hurt, but nothing was broken. Not even the shoulder she had heard pop. She drew a great shuddering breath, and her ribs expanded effortlessly, although she had heard them crack like branches in a windstorm. Except it had never been her bones breaking. She had heard the snapping of those Kevlar plates fitted into the back and shoulders of Lou's bulky motorcycle jacket. Lou had said you could catch a telephone pole at 20 miles an hour, wearing his coat, and still have a chance at getting back up. The next time Manx hit her, in the side, she shouted, more in surprise than pain, and heard another loud snap.
"You will want to answer me when I am speaking to you," Manx said.
Her side throbbed. She had felt that one, but the snap had only been another plate going. Her head was almost clear, and she thought if she made a great effort, she could heave herself to her feet.
"No, you don't," said her father, so close he might have been whispering in her ear. "You stay down and let him have his fun. This is not the time, brat."
She had given up on her father, had no use for him, and kept their few conversations as short as possible, did not want to hear from him. But now he was here, and he spoke to her in the same calm, measured tone of voice he'd use when he was explaining how to field a grounder or why Hank Williams mattered.
"He thinks he's busted you up real good, kiddo. He thinks you're beat. You try and get up now. He'll know you aren't as bad as he thinks you are, and then he will get you. Wait. Wait for the right time. You'll know it when it comes."
Her father's voice, her lover's jacket. For a moment she was aware of both the men in her life looking after her. She had thought they were both better off without her, and that she was better off without them. But now here, in the dirt, it came to her that she had never really gone anywhere without them.
"Do you hear me? Can you hear my voice?" Manx asked.
She didn't reply. She was perfectly still.
"Perhaps you do, and perhaps you don't," he said after a moment of thought.
She had not heard his voice in more than a decade, but it was still the dumbass drawl of a country rube.
"What a whore you look, crawling in the dirt in your skimpy little denim shorts. I remember a time, not so long ago, when even a whore would have been ashamed to appear in public dressed like you, and to spread her legs to ride a motorbike in lewd parody of the carnal act."
He paused again, then said, "You were on a bike the last time, too. I have not forgotten. I have not forgotten the bridge, either. Is this a special bike like that other one? I know about special rides, Victoria McQueen, and secret roads. I hope you gallivanted to your heart's content. You will not be gallivanting any more."
He slammed the hammer into the small of her back, and it was like catching a baseball bat in the kidneys, and she screamed through clenched teeth. Her insides felt smashed, jellied. No armor there. None of the other times had been like that. Another blow like that one, and she would need crutches to get to her feet. Another blow like that one, and she would be pissing blood.
"You will not be riding your bike to the bar, either, or to the pharmacy to get the medicine you take for your crazy head. Oh, I know all about you, Victoria McQueen, Miss Liar Liar Pants on Fire. I know what a sorry drunk you are, and what an unfit mother, and that you have been to the Laughing House. I know you had your son out of wedlock, which of course is quite usual for whores such as yourself. To think we live in a world where one such as you is allowed to have a child. Well, your boy is with me now. You stole my children away from me with your lies, and now I claim yours from you."
Vic's insides knotted. It was as bad as being struck again. She was afraid she might throw up in her helmet. Her right hand was pressed hard against her side, into the sick, bunched feeling in her abdomen. Her fingers traced the outline of something in her coat pocket. A crescent sickle shape. Manx bent over her. When he spoke again, his voice was gentle.
"Your son is with me, and you will never have him back. I don't expect you to believe this, Victoria, but he is better off with me. I will bring him more happiness than you ever could. In Christmas Land, I promise you, he will never be unhappy again. If you had a single grateful bone in your body, you would thank me."
He prodded her with the hammer and leaned closer.
"Come now, Victoria. Say it. Say thank you."
She pushed her right hand into her pocket. Her finger closed around the wrench that was shaped like a knife. Her thumb felt the ridges of the stamp that said Triumph.
"Now. Now is the moment. Make it count," her father told her.
Lou kissed her on the temple, his lips brushing her softly. Vic shoved herself up. Her back spasmed, a sick flexing in the muscle, almost intense enough to cause her to stagger. But she did not even allow herself to grunt in pain. She saw him in a blur. He was tall in a way she associated with funhouse mirrors. rail-thin legs and arms that went on forever. He had great, fixed, staring eyes, and for the second time in the space of minutes, she thought of fish. He looked like a mounted fish. All his upper teeth bit down into his lower lip, giving him an expression of comic, ignorant bafflement. It was incomprehensible that her entire life had been a carousel of unhappiness, drinking, failed promises, and loneliness, all turning around and around a single afternoon encounter with this man. She jerked the wrench out of her pocket. It snagged on fabric, and for one terrible instant it almost dropped out of her fingers. She held on, pulled it loose, and slashed it at his eyes. The blow went a little high. The sharp tip of the wrench caught him above the left temple and tore open a 4-inch flap of his curiously soggy, loose skin. She felt it grinding raggedly across bone. "Thank you," she said. Manx clapped one gaunt hand to his forehead. His expression suggested a man who has been struck by a sudden, dismaying thought. He staggered back from her. One heel slipped in the grass. She stabbed at his throat with the wrench, but he was already out of reach, falling across the hood of his wraith.
"Mom! Oh, Mom!" Wayne screamed from somewhere.
Vic's legs were loose and unstable beneath her. She didn't think about it. She went after him. Now that she was up and on her feet, she could see he was an old, old man. He looked like he belonged in a nursing home, a blanket over his knees, a Metamucil shake in one hand. She could take him, pin him to the hood and stab him in the fucking eyes with her pointy little wrench. She was almost on top of him when he came up with the silver hammer in his right hand. He gave it a big, swooping swing. She heard it whistle musically in the air and caught her in the side of her helmet, hard enough to snap her around 180 degrees and drop her to one knee. She heard cymbals clash in her skull, just like a cartoon sound effect. He looked 80 going on 1,000, but there was a limber, easy strength in his swing that suggested the power of a gangly teenager. Glassy chips of motorcycle helmet fell into the grass. If she had not been wearing it, her skull would have been sticking out of her brain in a mess of red splinters.
"Oh," Charlie Manx was screaming. "Oh, my Lord, I have been sliced open like a side of beef. Bang, bang."
Vic got up too quickly. The late afternoon darkened around her as the blood rushed from her head. She heard a car door slam. She reeled around, holding her head, the helmet, between her hands, trying to stop the dreadful reverberations resounding within it. The world was jittering just a little, as if she sat on her idling motorcycle again. Manx was still collapsed across the hood of the car. His harrowed, stupid face shone with blood. But there was another man now, standing at the back end of the car. Or at least it had the shape of a man. It had the head, though, of a giant insect from some 1950s black-and-white movie, a rubbery monster movie head with a grotesque bristling mouth and glassy blank eyes. The insect man had a gun. Vic watched it float up and stared into the black barrel, a surprisingly tiny hole, not much bigger than a human iris. "Bang, bang," the insect man said.
The Yard.
When Bing saw Mr. Manx sprawl across the hood of the car, he felt it as a kind of physical jolt, a sensation of recoil. He had felt much the same thing travel up his arm the day he had fired the nail gun into his father's temple. Only this was a slam of recoil into the very center of his being. Mr. Manx, the good man, was stabbed in the face, and the bitch was coming at him. The bitch meant to kill him, a thought as unimaginable, as horrible, as the sun itself blinking out. The bitch was coming, and Mr. Manx needed him. Bing gripped the can of ginger snap spice, pointed it in the boy's face, and blasted a hissing stream of pale smoke into his mouth and eyes. What he should have done minutes ago, what he would have done if he hadn't been so awful mad, if he hadn't decided to make the boy watch. The kid flinched, tried to turn his face, but Bing held him by the hair and kept spraying. Wayne Carmody shut his eyes and clamped his lips shut.
"Bing! Bing!" Mac screamed.
Bing screamed himself, desperate to be out of the car and moving, and aware at the same time that he had not dosed the boy well. It didn't matter. There was no time, and the boy was in the car now, couldn't leave. Bing let go of him and dropped the can of ginger snap spice into one pocket of his tracksuit jacket. His right hand was pawing for the pistol in the other pocket. He was out then, slamming the door behind him and pulling out the big oiled revolver. She had on a black motorcycle helmet that showed only her eyes, wide now, seeing the gun in his hand, seeing the last thing she was ever going to see. 3 steps away at most, right in his kill zone. "Bing, bing," he said. "Time to do my thing." He had already begun to apply pressure on the trigger when Mr. Manx pushed himself up off the hood, putting himself right in the way. The gun went off, and Manx's left ear exploded in a spray of skin and blood. Manx screamed, clapped his hand to the side of his head where raggedy pieces of ear now hung from the side of his face. Bing screamed, too, and fired again into the mist. The sound of the gun going off a second time, when he wasn't prepared for it, startled him so badly that he farted, a high squeak in his pants. "Mr. Manx! Oh, my God! Mr. Manx! Are you all right?" Mr. Manx dropped against the side of the car, twisting his head around to look at him.
"Well, what do you think? I have been stabbed in the face and my ear is shot to pieces. I am lucky my brains are not running down the front of my shirt, you dumbbell."
"Oh, my God, I am such an asshole. I didn't mean it, Mr. Manx. I would rather die than hurt you. What do I do? Oh, God, I should just shoot myself."
"You should shoot her is what you should do," Manx yelled at him, dropping his hand from the side of his head. Red strings of ear dangled and swung. "Do it. Shoot her already. Put her down. Put her down in the dirt and have done with it."
Bing wrenched his gaze away from the good man, his heart slugging in his chest. Kabam, bam, bam. Like a piano pushed down a flight of stairs in a great crash of discordant sound and slamming wood. His gaze swept the yard and found McQueen, already on the run, loping away from him on her long brown legs. His ears were ringing so loudly he could hardly hear his own gun as it went off again, flame shredding through the ghost silk of the fog. Logan Airport. Lou Carmody cleared security and still had an hour to kill, so he hit Mickey D's in the food court. He told himself he would get the grilled chicken salad and a water, but the air was full of the hungry-making odor of French fries, and when he got to the cash register, he heard himself telling the pimply kid he wanted 2 Big Macs, large fries, and an extra-large vanilla milkshake, the same thing he'd been ordering since he was 13. While he was waiting, he looked to his right and saw a little boy, no more than 8, with dark eyes just like Wayne's, standing with his mother at the next register. The boy stared up at Lou, at Lou's 2 chins and man tits, not with disgust, but with a strange sorrow. Lou's father had been so fat when he died that they had to pay for a special order coffin, a fucking double wide that looked like a dinner table with the lid shut. "Just make it a small milkshake," Lou told his server. He found himself unable to look at the boy again, was afraid to see him staring. What shamed him was not that he was, as his doctor said, morbidly obese. What a qualifier, morbidly, as if at a certain point being overweight were morally similar to necrophilia. What he hated, what made him feel squirmy and ill inside, was his own inability to change his habits. He genuinely could not say the things he needed to say, could not order the salad when he smelled French fries. The last year he had been with Vic, he knew she needed help, that she was drinking in secret, that she was answering imaginary phone calls, but he could not draw the line with her, could not make demands or issue ultimatums. And if she was blasted and wanted to screw him, he could not say he was worried about her. All he could do was clap his hands to her ass and bury his face in her naked breasts. He had been her accomplice right until the day she filled the oven with telephones and burned their house to the ground. He had done everything but light the match himself. He settled at a table designed for an anorexic dwarf, in a chair only suitable for the ass of a 10-year-old. Didn't McDonald's understand their clientele? What were they thinking, providing chairs like this for men like him? Pulled out his laptop and got on the free Wi-Fi. He checked his email and looked at cosplay honeys and power girl outfits. He dropped in on the Miller World message boards. Some friends were debating which color Hulk should be next. Comic dorks embarrassed him, the dumb shit they argued about. It was obviously gray or green. The other colors were stupid. Lou was wondering if he could look at suicide girls without anyone walking by and noticing, when his phone began to hum in the pocket of his cargo shorts. He lifted his rear end and began to dig for it. He had his hand on it when he tuned in on the music playing over the airport sound system. It was, improbably, that old Johnny Mathis song, Sleigh Ride. Improbable because Boston was roughly as temperate as Venus on that particular afternoon in July. It made Lou sweat just looking outside. Not only that, the airport sound system had been rocking something else right up until the moment the phone rang. Lady Gaga or Amanda Palmer or something. Some cute lunatic with a piano. Lou had his phone out but paused to look at the woman at the next table. A MILF who bore a scant resemblance to Sarah Palin. "Dude," Lou said, "you hear that?" pointing at the ceiling. "They're playing Christmas music. It's the middle of the summer." She froze with a forkful of coleslaw halfway to her bee-stung lips and stared at him with a mixture of confusion and unease. "The song," Lou said. "You hear that song?" Her brow furrowed. She regarded in the way she might have regarded a puddle of vomit, something to avoid. Lou glanced at his phone, saw Wayne on the caller ID. That was curious. They had just been texting a few minutes ago. Maybe Vic was back from her ride on the Triumph and wanted to talk to him about how it was running. "Never mind," Lou said to almost Sarah Palin and waved a hand in the air, dismissing the subject. He answered. "What up, dog?" Lou said.
"Dad,"
Wayne said, his voice a harsh whisper. He was struggling not to cry.
"Dad, I'm in the back of a car. I can't get out."
Lou felt a low, almost gentle ache behind his breastbone, in his neck, and curiously, behind his left ear.
"What do you mean? What car?" "They're going to kill Mom. The two men. There's two men, and they put me in a car, and I can't get out of the back seat. It's Charlie Manx, Dad, and someone in a gas mask. Someone..."
He screamed. In the background, Lou heard a string of popping sounds. His first thought was firecrackers, but it wasn't firecrackers. Wayne cried,
"They're shooting Dad! They're shooting at Mom!"
"Get out of the car!" Lou heard himself say, his voice strange, thin, too high. He was hardly aware he had come to his feet. "Just unlock the door and run!"
"I can't, I can't! It won't unlock, and when I try and get in the front seat, I just wind up in the back again."
Wayne choked on a sob. Lou's head was a hot air balloon filled with buoyant gases, lifting him up off the floor toward the ceiling. He was in danger of sailing right out of the real world. "The door has to unlock. Look around, Wayne."
"I have to go. They're coming back. I'll call when I can." "Don't call me. They might hear it. They might hear even if I turn it to mute."
"Wayne! Wayne!" Lou screamed. There was a strange ringing in his ears. The phone went dead. Everyone in the food court was staring at him. No one was saying anything. A pair of security cops were approaching, one of them with his hand resting on the molded plastic grip of his .45. Lou thought, call the state police. Call the New Hampshire State Police. Do it right now. But when he lowered the phone from his face to dial 911, it slipped from his hand. And when he bent to reach for it, he found himself grabbing at his chest, the pain there suddenly doubling, jabbing at him with sharp edges. It was as if someone had fired a staple gun into one tit. He put his hand on the little table to steady himself, but then his elbow folded and he went down, chin first. He caught the edge of the table, and his teeth clacked together, and he grunted and collapsed onto the floor. His shake went with him. The wax cup exploded, and he sprawled into a cold, sweet puddle of vanilla ice cream. He was only 36, way too young for a heart attack, even with his family history. He had known he would pay for not getting the salad. Lake Winnipesaukee. When the gas mask man appeared with his gun, Vic tried to backpedal but couldn't seem to get a signal to her legs. The barrel of the gun held her in place was as captivating as a mesmerist's pocket watch. She might as well have been buried in the ground up to her hips. Then Manx stood up between her and the gunman, and the .38 went off, and Manx's left ear tore apart in a red flash. Manx screamed, a wretched cry, not of pain but of fury. The gun went off a second time. Vic saw the agitated mist swirl to her right, a very straight line of cleared air running through it to mark the passage of the bullet. "If you stand here one moment longer, he will shoot you to death in front of Wayne," her father told her, his hand in the small of her back. "Don't stand here and let Wayne see that." She darted a look at the car through the windshield, and her son was there in the back seat. His face was flushed and rigid, and he was furiously swiping one hand in the air at her. "Go! Go! Get away!" Vic didn't want him to see her running, either, leaving him behind. All the other times she had failed him before were nothing to this final, unforgivable failure. A thought lanced through her like a bullet tunneling through mist. "If you die here, no one can find Manx."
"Wayne!" she shouted. "I'll come! Wherever you go, I'll find you!"
She didn't know if he heard her. She could hardly hear herself. Her ears whined, shocked into something close to deafness by the roar of the gas-masked man's .38. She could barely hear Manx yelling to her, "Shoot her! Shoot her already!" Her heels squeaked in the wet grass as she turned. She was moving at last. She lowered her head, grabbing at her helmet, wanting it off before she got where she was going. She felt comically slow, feet spinning furiously beneath her, going nowhere, while the grass bunched up under her in rolls, like carpet. There was no sound in the world but for the heavy drumming of her feet on the ground and her breath amplified by the inside of the helmet. The gas mask man was going to shoot her in the back, bullet in the spine, and she hoped it killed her, because she did not want to lie there sprawled in the dirt, paralyzed, waiting for him to shoot her again. "In the back," she thought. "In the back. In the back." The only three words her mind could seem to string together. Her entire vocabulary had been reduced to these three words. She was halfway down the hill. She yanked the helmet off at last, threw it aside. The gun boomed. Something skipped off the water to her right, as if a child had flung a flat stone across the lake. Vic's feet were on the boards of the dock. The dock heaved and slammed beneath her. She took three bounding steps and dived at the water. She struck the surface, thought of the bullet slicing through the fog again, and then she was in the lake. She was underwater. She plunged almost all the way to the bottom, where the world was dark and slow. It seemed to Vic that she had, only moments before, been in the dim, green, drowned world of the lake, that she was returning to the quiet, restful state of unconsciousness. The woman sailed through the cold stillness. A bullet struck the lake to her left, less than half a foot from her, punching a tunnel in the water, corkscrewing into the darkness, slowing rapidly. Vic recoiled and lashed out blindly, as if it could be slapped away. Her hand closed on something hot. She opened her palm, stared at what looked like a lead weight for a fishing line. The disturbed currents rolled it out of her hand, and it sank into the lake, and only after it was gone did she understand she had grabbed a bullet. She twisted, scissored her legs, gazing up now, lungs beginning to hurt. She saw the surface of the lake, a bright silver sheet high over her head. The float was another 10-15 feet away. Vic surged through the water. Her chest was a throbbing vault filled with fire. She kicked and kicked. Then she was under it, under the black rectangle of the float. She clawed for the surface. She thought of her father, the stuff he used to blast rock, the slippery white plastic packs of Anfo. Her chest was packed full with Anfo, ready to explode. Her head burst up out of the water, and she gasped, filling her lungs with air. Vic was in deep shadow, under the boards of the float, between the ranks of rusting iron drums. It smelled of creosote and rot. Vic fought to breathe quietly. Every exhalation echoed in the small, low space. "I know where you are," screamed the gas mask man. "You can't hide from me." His voice was piping and raggedy and childish. He was a child, Vic understood then. He might be 30 or 40 or 50, but he was still just another of Manx's poisoned children. And yes, he probably did know where she was. "Come and get me, you little fuck," she thought, and wiped her face. She heard another voice then. Manx. Manx was calling to her, crooning almost.
"Victoria, Victoria, Victoria McQueen."
There was a gap between two of them.